Picture yourself in a briefing tent in the Burmese jungle, summer of 1941. The monsoon is hammering the canvas over your head outside. On a grass strip carved out of the teak forest, sit a row of Curtiss P-40 Warhawks, painted on each nose staring back at you. A set of white shark teeth, a leering red mouth, painted eyes above it. They do not look like American military aircraft, they look like something out of a fever dream. The man at the front of the tent is not in uniform. He is a civilian. He is 50 years old. He is nearly deaf in both ears. The Army Air Corps threw him out 4 years ago, and he is about to teach you how to fight the Imperial Japanese Air Force. His name is Claire Lee Chennault, and what he is about to hand you may be the most important piece of paper you have ever held in a cockpit briefing. I'm Tail Dragger. This is the Hangar on Radio Hangar. Today we are talking about the Flying Tigers, the American volunteer group, and one of the most improbable air campaigns in the history of combat aviation. 100 American pilots who resigned their military commissions flew halfway around the world and held the line over Burma and China before most of their countrymen knew the war had even started. Before we get into it, a word from the folks keeping the lights on here. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in your flying life. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, commercial, all the way up. You earned it. They have a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Now back to that briefing tent. To understand the Flying Tigers, you have to understand Claire Chennault, because the American volunteer group was really Chennault's idea, Chennault's vision, and in most respects, Chennault's army. He was born in Commerce, Texas in 1893. Flew in the First World War, though he never got overseas before the armistice. Stayed in the Army Air Service through the 20s and into the 30s, became one of the country's finest aerobatics and formation flying instructors. He also became one of the loudest, most stubborn voices in the service for what he called pursuit aviation, fighter planes, interception tactics, the idea that you could defend territory from the air if you had fast airplanes, good pilots, and smart tactics. The Army Air Corps was not particularly interested. The prevailing doctrine in the mid-1930s leaned heavily toward the bomber, strategic bombing. The idea that the bomber would always get through. Pursuit aviation was seen as defensive, limited, old-fashioned. Chennault wrote papers. He gave lectures. He argued in corridors and at tables where nobody was really listening. Part of the problem was literally that, by the mid-30s, his hearing was failing badly. Years of open cockpit flying, engine noise, slipstream, all of it accumulating. In 1937, the Army Air Corps put him on medical review, and within months he was out. Retired on a captain's pension at 43 years old. He could have gone fishing. Instead, he went to China. The Chinese nationalist government under Chiang Kai-shek was desperate for air power. Japan had invaded in 1937 and the Chinese Air Force was being methodically destroyed. A mutual friend introduced Chennault to Madame Chiang Kai-shek, who handled much of the government's foreign dealings. She offered him a contract as an air advisor. He accepted. For the next 3 years, Chennault did something that would prove worth more than any rank or salary. He watched the Japanese fly. He observed their formations, their tactics, their habits. He flew against them when he could. He interviewed Chinese pilots who had survived engagements. He filled composition notebooks with everything he saw. Now here's where it gets interesting. Japanese pilots had exceptional skills and their aircraft were genuinely formidable. The Mitsubishi Zero fighter, which would stun the world after Pearl Harbor, was already by 1940 an extraordinary dogfighter, light, nimble, remarkable range, beautiful climb rate. The Nakajima Ki 27 Army fighter had similar qualities. In a turning fight, close in, these aircraft were nearly unbeatable, but Chennault noted something the world had not yet learned to put into words. Japanese tactical doctrine relied almost entirely on the dogfight. The tight turning, close-in knife fight where their aircraft excelled, they expected any opponent to engage on those terms. And on those terms against a Zero or a Ki 27, you would lose every time. What he also noticed was what that design philosophy had cost them. No pilot armor, no self-sealing fuel tanks. Light construction that kept the weight down and the performance up, but meant that a single well-placed burst could turn the whole aircraft into a torch. Japanese pilots who went down rarely walked away. Their aircraft did not forgive being shot. He wrote all of it down. And in the fall of 1940, he made a trip back to Washington. His proposal was simple in outline and radical in practice. Give me 100 American pilots, 100 pursuit planes, and 6 months to train them. I will give you an air campaign over China that will hurt Japan badly, not because American pilots are inherently better, because they will know exactly what the Japanese are going to do before they do it, and they will not make the mistake of trying to beat the enemy at the enemy's own game. Getting approval took until spring of 1941 and required a covert executive order from President Franklin Roosevelt himself. The pilots would have to resign their commissions in the Army, Navy, and Marine Corps. Technically becoming civilians, the only way to avoid a diplomatic crisis with Japan, which the United States was still not at war with. They would be recruited quietly, the whole operation would be covered by a civilian contracting company. Chennault found his 100. Some were experienced. Many were young, a few were barely past initial training. They signed contracts with the Central Aircraft Manufacturing Company, a civilian shell that provided legal cover for the operation. Pay was $600 a month, considerably more than most had been earning in uniform, and there was a bonus of $500 for every confirmed Japanese aircraft destroyed.
The aircraft were Curtiss P-40B Tomahawks, export versions drawn from a British lend-lease contract. The Royal Air Force had decided they were not suitable for operations over Europe. Too slow at altitude for the newer German fighters. Not great in the climb. By the standards of the European air war in the summer of 1941, the P-40 was showing its age. Chennault did not want them for their climb rate. He wanted them for their dive speed, which was excellent. For their firepower, 650 caliber machine guns, which was formidable, and most of all for the fact that they were built like a vault compared to anything the Japanese were flying. Armor plate behind the pilot's head, self-sealing fuel tanks. A P-40 could take hits that would have turned a Zero into wreckage and still get its pilot home. The volunteers shipped out across the Pacific through the summer of 1941, arriving in Rangoon and from there overland to Kidao Airfield outside Tonggu in Burma. British territory then. The Royal Air Force let them use the field. Nobody announced their arrival. They set up tents, unpacked crates, and went to work. Training began in August. Three squadrons formed. The first squadron called themselves the Adam and Eves, the second the Panda Bears, the third, who would go on to defend Rangoon against some of the war's most ferocious raids, called themselves Hell's Angels. The shark mouth paint scheme that would make these aircraft recognizable to anyone who has ever looked at a picture of the Second World War came from, of all places, a magazine. Someone in the group had seen a photograph of Royal Air Force P-40s in the Western Desert, flown by the Royal Air Force's 112 Squadron, painted with identical shark teeth running from the prop spinner back to the cockpit. The Americans liked what they saw. The shark mouth became their signature. The name Flying Tigers came later, and its exact origin is disputed. The Chinese press called them Fei Hu, which translates roughly to Flying Tiger. American correspondents picked up the phrase. However it happened, by early 1942 the name was everywhere, and the men who flew those painted warhawks had no reason to argue with it. Chennault drilled his pilots on the two-ship element, the same pairing the German Luftwaffe had pioneered in Spain, and the best Allied commanders were slowly adopting. No more three-ship formations. Two planes, lead and wingman, never separate. Cover each other and the geometry of the fight takes care of itself, and the rule above all rules, the one Chennault repeated in every briefing, do not dogfight, do not turn with Japanese aircraft. You will lose. Instead, attack from above at high speed, one pass. Convert that dive into enough energy to zoom back to altitude or extend away and set up the next run. Hit and run. Make them chase you into a descent they cannot match. Draw them down where your firepower could finish the engagement in a single accurate burst. He gave each pilot a specific breakdown of every Japanese type they might encounter. Where the aircraft burned. Where the structure failed. What the pilot would do when surprised. What he would do when cornered. Chennault had been watching these aircraft and these men for 3 years. His pilots absorbed it in weeks. There was one more piece of the picture that made everything work. Chennault had spent his time in China building a ground observer network, spotters, stationed at strategic points across the country, linked by telephone and shortwave radio, who would report Japanese aircraft movements the moment formations were spotted climbing out of their bases. By the time a Japanese bomber formation crossed into Chinese airspace, Chennault often knew its heading, approximate altitude, and the composition of its escort. His fighters could be airborne and climbing before the enemy reached the border, positioned above and ahead, waiting in the sun. The Japanese never understood how the Americans always seemed to be in the right place. They suspected sophisticated detection equipment. Some kind of intelligence penetration at a very high level. It was neither. It was a retired captain nobody had wanted to listen to, a composition notebook and a telephone network stretching across a country the size of a continent. The American Volunteer Group, or AVG as the pilots came to call it, flew its first combat mission on December 20, 1941. 12 days after Pearl Harbor, a formation of 10 Japanese Ki-48 light bombers was inbound for Kunming, the southern terminus of the Burma Road, the main supply lifeline for nationalist China. Four P-40s from Hell's Angels intercepted them over the mountains east of the city. When it was over, four Japanese aircraft had been shot down. The AVG lost none. The bombing of Kunming did not happen that day. Over the weeks that followed, the pattern held. Over Rangoon, which Hell's Angels defended through December and into February, while the British forces were pulling back through Burma, the AVG knocked down Japanese aircraft at a rate that the mathematics of air combat had not prepared anyone to see. Formations of 40 bombers escorted by 20 fighters would meet a dozen P-40s and come away shredded. The city of Rangoon, a major port essential to Allied supply lines, continued to function long after it should have fallen. The reason was a small group of American pilots and a handful of aircraft flying out of a grass strip. They could not hold it forever, but they held it long enough to matter. On Christmas Day of 1941, a pilot from Vermont named Robert Hedman, whose call sign was Duke, personally shot down five Japanese aircraft in a single engagement over Rangoon. Five confirmed kills in one mission. He would end the campaign as one of the unit's leading aces. Pilots like Tex Hill from Columbia, South Carolina, Jack Newkirk from Scarsdale, New York, and a dozen others became names that filtered back through the newspapers to a country that badly needed to hear them. This was not a time when news from the Pacific was encouraging. Wake Island had fallen. The Philippines were falling. The Japanese advance seemed unstoppable and systematic. From China came something different. American pilots fighting and winning. For a country absorbing the shock of Pearl Harbor, the news from the AVG was more than military information. It was evidence that the situation was not hopeless. These were not career officers with years of pre-war experience and the full weight of the American military behind them. They were volunteers, flying export model fighters that Europe had already passed on, eating out of cans in the Burmese jungle, and they were beating the Japanese Air Force at a ratio that senior officers in Washington found nearly impossible to believe. The AVG continued operations as the Japanese pushed north through Burma in the spring of 1942, supporting the Allied fighting retreat and continuing to intercept raids against Chinese targets. The workload was brutal. Maintenance crews working from improvised facilities with inadequate spare parts kept the P-40s flying through determination and improvisation that deserves its own story. The American Volunteer Group was officially disbanded on July 4, 1942, and absorbed into the United States Army Air Forces as the 23rd Fighter Group. Many of the original volunteers chose to return home rather than re-enter military service when their contracts expired. Some stayed and flew on under the new designation. Chenault stayed. He received his commission back, was promoted, and eventually commanded the 14th Air Force in China for the remainder of the war, reaching the rank of Major General. He never stopped being difficult, never stopped fighting over strategy and resources with his superiors. He was frequently right about those arguments, too. He passed away in New Orleans in 1958. The official tally for the AVG's 7 months of combat was 297 Japanese aircraft destroyed. 14 of the AVG's own pilots were killed in air combat, 14 against close to 300. That ratio was the direct product of Chenault's method. Know your enemy better than your enemy knows himself. Build your tactics around the actual capabilities of the aircraft you have, not the aircraft you wish you had. Never fight the other man's fight on the other man's terms. The P-40s are mostly gone now. A handful have been restored and still fly the airshow circuit. When you see one with the shark teeth, that paint carries weight. It was put there first by young Americans who had signed away their commissions, crossed an ocean, and gone to fight a war their country had not yet officially entered. Following a half-deaf captain, nobody else had been willing to take seriously. My sources today include Daniel Ford's research on the American Volunteer Group and the National Archives records from the China-Burma-India Theater, more at radiohangar.com. This is Taildragger. Keep the shiny side up.